Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Evidence of voter fraud, the lack of a suspect, and claims of, quote, criminal media reporting are where we begin the roundup this week. Palm Beach County prosecutors dropped a case looking into voter fraud over absentee ballots in a county commission and state house election last August. While there was evidence of fake signatures of requests for mail-in ballots, prosecutors just could not find anyone to accuse. In the meantime, Broward County Supervisor of Elections Brenda Snipes is scheduled to testify Monday in a trial challenging her office's management of that county's voter rolls. The conservative group American Civil Rights Union is going after voter lists across the country. It was Broward County. It has asked Broward County to do more to remove ineligible people from its voter registration rolls. And all of this, of course, is happening here in South Florida as President Trump's Voter Fraud Commission continues asking for voter data from the state of Florida. So this is where we begin the roundup this week. Is your vote safe? Are absentee ballot rules in Florida strong enough to avoid questions about their validity? Have you changed your voter registration status over concerns about what's publicly available and what may be shared with the presidential commission? Call us, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. From Key West up to Jupiter, you can also tweet us at WLRN and look for us on Facebook. Sergio Bustos is senior editor for Politico Florida. He's with us in studio. Always great to have you back, Sergio. Thanks to be here.
Thank you.
Lawrence Maurer is a reporter with the Palm Beach Post's investigative team. He is with us from studios in Boynton Beach. Lawrence, let's begin with you up in Palm Beach County. What are the facts of the investigation into these allegations of voter fraud in last August's primary election?
Well, what the state attorney's office found is that, in that August primary, they found 22 people whose signatures were forged on absentee ballot request forms. Now, these are the kind of paper forms that you have to send in order to receive an absentee ballot. And, of these 22 people, some of them were, one of them was actually a state attorney's office employee and her three family members. Hmm. And 17 of these 22 were all within an area of Riviera Beach and West Palm Beach in which three candidates, their districts all seem to overlap. And that's County Commissioner Mac Bernard, State House Rep Al Jaquette, and State Senator Bobby Powell.
So were there, in the prosecutor's report that the Post reported on this week and you reported on, Lawrence, are there official accusations that voter fraud did occur?
They call it voter fraud in the report. Now, the report has a number of problems in it that we've dug into and other people have dug into, but they classify it as voter fraud.
And the fraud that they're alleging here isn't fraud with the actual ballot, but it's fraud with the request for what we used to call absentee ballots, now called mail-in ballots. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, they're called mail-in ballots now because you don't actually have to be absentee to get one.
And Lawrence, is that breaking the law? Is that against the law in the state of Florida to sign your name to somebody else's absentee ballot request?
Absolutely. It's actually, they classified in the report as felony forgery, but it's also illegal to request an absentee ballot for someone else who is not a family member. They don't actually mention that in the report, which is one of the weird things about it. But so each one of these counts would actually be two felonies.
I want to talk more about this this report out of Palm Beach County this week. Lawrence Maurer is along with us, investigative reporter for the Palm Beach Post with us from Boynton Beach. As I mentioned, Sergio Bustos is along with us in studios here in Miami, senior editor for Politico Florida. Sergio, you have done your fair share of stories and investigations into the use of absentee ballots. What's the history and really the troubled history of them in Florida?
You know, it's interesting. Congratulations to Lawrence's report. It really was a truly revealing report, and unfortunately, I don't think the authorities seem to be able to want to do anything or can't do anything. But it was a really very revealing report. But it highlights that time and time again, absentee ballots are the real problem when it comes to election fraud and voter fraud. Despite what the Trump Commission is looking at, people illegally voting, that really isn't the issue. You have to ask yourself, what's the motivation for a single person to vote illegally? Very little to none, I would say. On the other hand, as Lawrence's report points out, it's a campaign that tries to gather up enough absentee ballots Which is a much easier task for them to do. That's where the real problem lies.
Lawrence, in this case, the 22 ballots that were identified in this prosecutorial report from the Palm Beach County State's Attorney's Office, the 22 ballots with forged signatures on requests for ballots, did they change the outcome of any of these elections?
These 22, we don't really know. I mean, no. The 22 themselves, no. That wouldn't have made a difference. But, you know, when you look at these three races, you saw that for two of them, these candidates actually lost at the polls. People who actually showed up to vote voted for the other guy. But when all these absentee ballots started pouring in, these candidates got crushed. So the absentee ballots were absolutely the factor in at least two of these elections.
So let me break that down a little bit, Lawrence, to make sure I understand what you're saying. The losing candidate in these races back in, there was a primary race in August. The losing candidate actually won on Election Day. But when the absentee mail-in ballots were counted, they did not have enough votes to be declared the winner. Is that right?
Exactly. Like Priscilla Taylor, for example, she's the county commissioner. She was the incumbent in that race. She actually had something like 770 votes over her opponent, Mac Bernard, on Election Day. But she lost in absentees by about 1,200, 1,300 almost. So she lost the race because of that.
And Sergio, this troubled history of absentee ballots, why isn't it getting enough attention, not only the part of a presidential advisory commission about voting integrity, but also at the state level? You know, we've seen Governor Scott unsuccessfully during his first administration try to force county election supervisors to call their rolls of folks that he thought were illegally registered.
Well, as Lawrence's report points out, and I've done stories like this myself, it's pretty labor-intensive. Think about it. When a person goes to the polls, it's a very transparent process. There's a person at a table, checks you in with an ID, you go in and vote. It's very open. On the other hand, filling out an absentee ballot application, filling out an absentee ballot, is something done behind closed doors, and it's almost, it's almost like a, like checking out a library book. You know, it's done on honor that, yes, you are doing this correctly. And you can see just from his report how it's done. To me, it's like a classic case. You get someone in that fills out the absentee application for them. They bring the ballot to the voter, which, again, illegal. Then they actually fill it out for them, yeah. As he points out. Yeah. It's almost like that's the way it's done, and it's very easily done, I think.
Lawrence Maurer, the investigative reporter of the Palm Beach Post, I'll ask a very lawyerly question. Through this prosecutorial report about voter fraud in the August primary, what was the chain of custody of these mail-in ballot requests and the ballot themselves?
We don't know because it's almost entirely not addressed in the 24-page report. What we do know is that they do mention a person of interest that they were looking at. It was a guy by the name of Delano Allen. And they described Delano Allen as working for a company called Sky Administrations, which is a kind of an election campaign company that made signs for these three candidates, almost exclusively for these three candidates. And it's actually owned by, that company is actually owned by Mac Bernard's aide. That's, of course, not mentioned in the report at all. But this guy, Delano Allen, was seen on video dropping off bundles of absentee request forms at the Supervisor of Elections office. And that got the Supervisor of Elections, Susan Bucher, really, that was one of the things that triggered her to ask law enforcement to intervene. But police never actually interviewed Delano Allen. Now, they never sat him down for an interview. And they did not mention also in the report that Delano Allen is Bobby Powell's legislative aide.
And this in lies the reaction that your investigative reporting solicited from the state senator. Senator Powell called the media coverage of this prosecutor's report criminal.
Yeah, we noted Powell said that he was not mentioned in the report. Basically, that nothing in the report indicates that he did anything wrong. And the report is good in not naming anyone. It's actually kind of weird. They only mention specific campaigns, but they don't mention who. But and of course, they don't mention that Delano Allen is Bobby Powell's legislative aide. And he was the guy on video, seen turning in these things. And the report also doesn't mention, it didn't follow up on any of our reporting, for one, because we did a big investigation on this where we found candidates were actually going into people's homes and pressuring them to vote. And in one case, a blind guy said that Mac Bernard actually filled out and signed his ballot. And we actually verified the signature. This blind guy's ballot did count, and the signature was nowhere close to the one that was on file, which raises a whole other issue. Basically, there is no verification for, if you have to show an ID at the polls now.
Right.
But
right.
For the only verification for absentees is a signature, and that is a ridiculously poor way to verify somebody's identity.
Talking about the sanctity and the security of voting in the Sunshine State, 800-743-9576. Do you sense that your vote is safe? We're coming up to an election cycle here, a lot of municipal elections this fall, for instance, in a big 2018 governor's race and U.S. Senate race. The federal government, the White House, is looking into voting integrity. How do you feel about the safety of your vote and your voting registration? 800-743-WLRN, 743-9576. We begin in Miami. Dave, you are on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Governor Scott, of course, was all too willing to give Trump the Trump administration the kind of information that they wanted on voter registrations. And of course, many times in many states, this is used to throw out registered voters, saying, "Oh, you're not qualified," or this or that. There's only one reason for this, and this is to throw out or to be able to prevent any Democrat from voting in any elections or having his vote count statewide, countywide, or nationwide. They are aiming for one thing and one thing only, and that is one-party rule nationwide.
Dave,
the Republicans.
I hear you, but I want to correct you on one thing. When you talk about Governor Scott giving the Trump administration voter data, what the Secretary of State of Florida has said repeatedly, that the Trump Advisory Committee on Voting Integrity will receive voting information from Florida that is already publicly available. Nothing more, less.
Oh, okay. Well, it's already publicly available, but still, it's going to be in the hands of the. It was in the hands of the state administration before. Now it's going to be in the hands of a president whose ethics are questionable,
Dave,
say the least.
We hear you loud and clear. I appreciate it. This idea, certainly your thoughts, Dave, of attempt to suppress Democratic vote. Lawrence, in Palm Beach, with the races that were the focus of this investigation regarding fraudulent absentee ballot requests, what do we know about the politics involved?
Well, all three of these were Democrats in the Democratic primary. Since the state attorney's report has come out, there's been a lot of focus on the state attorney being a Democrat also, and a Democrat who is rumored to be seeking a congressional seat next year. And I'll have a story in Sunday's paper kind of getting into that more. But there wasn't any involvement by Trump that we found or anything kind of like that. I mean, it was really just a very orchestrated campaign by three people to generate incredible absentee turnout.
Chuck is on line three in Miami. Chuck, thanks for holding. You are on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. First, I'd like to say I enjoy absentee or mail-in ballot voting, mostly because I can research who's available as I'm going through the list. I don't typically bring that information with me when I go to the poll. But an idea for security in regard to the mail-in ballots would be, if you've ever had your Social Security number compromised and had to file your taxes, you get a PIN in the mail from the federal government before you get before the deadline that your taxes are due. There could be an area on the ballot where you would bubble in a PIN that would be scanned and authorized along with your ballot, or you could pick one when you sign up for absentee. And if they're not verifying signatures as it is, there's no security for the mail-in ballots as it is.
Interesting idea, Chuck. Hopefully some election supervisors are listening here. We appreciate the idea and looking forward to move this forward. Sergio, we have seen a huge expansion in early voting opportunities in the state of Florida, not only in days, but also the ability to have these mail-in ballots, formerly called absentee ballots. In this effort toward opening up, participating in the election process beyond election day. Have the security measures just not kept up with the interest of trying to increase participation?
Well, I think it's an interesting point because, in fact, you do have, as you point out, this growing ease in which to vote. But I would point out, too, that, for instance, this week we had a state Senate race that few people actually were kind of aware of. But in state Senate District 40, they had a total of about 12,000 votes. About 12.5% of the electorate came out and voted.
And these were primary races.
And this was a primary race.
And if we do close primaries in Florida, you got to be registered to one of the parties in order to vote.
But this is a perfect area to go in and do absentee ballots because, you know, a couple hundred votes here and there could really make the difference.
Yeah.
I think on a larger scale, it's very hard. And again, you got to see the motivation. It would take a presidential candidate working across how many counties there are, thousands, whatever counties across the country, because the way our voting system is done, it's individual counts. It would be very hard.
And Sergio, you make a great point. And Lawrence, I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, because the Presidential Advisory Commission on Voting Integrity is really taking this national look. And when there were a lot of concerns in the buildup to the November 2016 election, one of the strengths of the federal election process was stated is that each of them are state-run. And in those states, they are county-run or municipal-run. So in the state of Florida, you have 67 county election supervisors. So the ability to do any kind of comprehensive hack for a national election is very difficult. That said, Lawrence, what you've identified in your reporting with the Palm Beach Post and even the prosecutors identified, down to that municipal, the smaller the election, is it the greater the risk?
Yeah, absolutely. It's as Sergio said, it's almost always in these smaller races that this happens, where they're easier to swing, they're easier to sway. There have been 20 people since 2010, at least 20, who have been arrested for absentee ballot fraud. And it was almost all in these small races where, you know, an election hinges on a couple hundred votes. And, you know, that's kind of what these people saw in August in Palm Beach County.
In the Palm Beach County investigation, is this two-dozen-page report the final statement on it, Lawrence? Detectives moving on to something else?
Probably, yeah. We have not gotten a real statement from the state attorney's office about this report and the problems in it, which are substantial. So this will probably close the case, yes.
Lawrence Maurer, investigative reporter from the Palm Beach Post, joining us from Boynton Beach. Sergio Bustos is going to stick along with us for the hour on the roundup. He is senior editor for Politico Florida. Lawrence, thank you so much for sharing your work with us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on the program, it's the wet season here, managing water and the environment. What questions do you have about moving water, when and where, throughout the southern tail of the peninsula here in the Sunshine State? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. The roundup continues after this. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening. 12.7 feet. That's about how high Lake Okeechobee is today on this Friday. It's well below the 15.5 feet level when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers begins releasing lake water to the east and west to reduce pressure on the Hoover Dike lining the southern rim of the lake. While algae blooms are back inside the lake, it's too much water south of Lake O that's been causing other problems in South Florida this wet season. Record June rainfall swelled canals and water retention areas, sending sheets of water out to sea and across sensitive wildlife areas. This week, the Army Corps said it would need another month to assess efforts to build a new reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. State money for that reservoir survived a political fight this spring in the state legislature. So here we are, the perennial issue of water management up next on the Florida Roundup. What's changed? What hasn't? And how Florida's flood management decisions are made? And how will the big work to replumb the Everglades affect where and how water moves across the peninsula and when? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Your questions, your comments. Also welcome on Twitter at WLRN. Sergio Bustos is still with us, senior editor for Politico Florida. Kate Stein covers the environment for us here at WLRN. Welcome back to the Roundup, Kate. Same to Jenny Stiletovich, environmental reporter for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios inside the Herald in Doral. Jenny, let's begin with the weather. Just how bad has the rain been this wet season?
Well, what happened early in June is there was record rain the very first week, and we got more in a week than we usually get for the whole month, and that started things off badly.
And this was south of Lake Okeechobee. This wasn't rain that necessarily has been flowing and filling up the lake, although that's part of it. This has really been localized in the southern tip of the peninsula, right?
It was also over the Everglades agriculture area that's right below the lake, along with those water conservation areas that kind of sit between east of the lake but west of the coastal development. So it was just a lot of rain in those areas that, you know, used to be marshes.
Kate, what do we know about the state of Lake Okeechobee here in the middle of the summer?
Well, so Lake Okeechobee, as you said, the water levels aren't too high, which is good. It means they don't have to do the releases from the lake that went east and west and helped fuel those blue-green algae blooms on Florida's coast last year. There's some algae in the lake right now, which isn't necessarily unusual for this time of year because the lake tends to have phosphorus levels and contaminants that kind of fuel those blooms, but they're not, I think, quite as problematic as we've seen last year. There's also been some back pumping to deal with the swollen waterways south of Lake O that were a result of those rains that Jenny was talking about.
So back pumping is water that's already south of Lake Okeechobee, back pumping it back into the lake, pumping it north essentially.
Right. Yeah.
And so Jenny, where does this kind of leave us? Like, what are those threatened areas if really the focus here has been on water management south of the Hoover Dike?
Well, the water conservation area, this vast area west of Broward County, holds a bunch of water. It's really high right now. There's a little bit of concern that there could be flooding in Broward. That's what the Corps wants to protect, the sort of levee that divides the conservation area from the neighborhoods. A bigger concern for some wildlife officials is the tree islands are flooded. Water levels are high. Wildlife tends to congregate on those tree islands. You get too dense a congregation, and then they get into trouble. That area is used a lot by hunters. They're unhappy with the water levels, so they're trying to move it off and move it south. One of the ways they moved it south, which they don't like to do, is into the western Everglades, where endangered Cape Sable seaside sparrows nest, and there is a schedule for when you can move water there. And they had to start, they moved it there too soon. So that set off some concerns about nesting sparrows, which were already kind of hammered by a lot of rain, early in June as well. We had a good dry season, so their nest numbers were up. But the other problem, sorry not to ramble on, but a lot of that water gets flushed out into the lower Biscayne Bay too, in giant plugs of fresh water, and that sort of upsets the balance there.
It reduces the salinity in the bay.
Correct.
Is that right? But it's too much fresh water too soon.
Correct.
You use the phrase, Jenny, move it south. And Kate Stein, we've heard that from Everglades advocates, that that's what needs to happen to the water from Lake Okeechobee. Instead of moving it east and west, like we've talked about for years, moving it south. So when we get these kinds of rainfalls and we have high water levels in the Everglades during the wet season, what's the problem?
Well, ideally, we would be moving water south because that was the natural flow of the Everglades before, you know, everyone moved to South Florida and we dredged some areas and we created these channels from Lake Okeechobee that shoot the water east and west when the lake gets too high. And so what basically the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the South Florida Water Management District are involved in the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. Mm-hmm. And the goal of this plan is, in a nutshell, to just restore that natural flow south through Taylor Slough and out, you know, into Florida Bay. And rather than having just torrents of water shooting east and west, it'd be a slower, much more gradual natural flow.
And Taylor Slough is that river of grass that runs essentially right underneath Tamiami Trail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You talked about the Army Corps of Engineers. Jenny Stiletovich, we heard from the Corps of Engineers this week essentially saying it's not going to be ready by an August 1st deadline to assess this new legislatively approved effort to build more water storage south of Lake Okeechobee. Why not?
Well, I think they just want to take their time and make sure they get this report correct. I mean, to me, asking for another month didn't seem like such a big, big delay. Also, though, to point out, not to get too much in the weeds, but it's Shark River that runs south of the Tamiami Trail, and Taylor Slough is on the eastern side of the park, and they want to restore water in both places.
Gotcha. No, always correct my geography, and when we're talking about the Everglades, you can't help but get out in the weeds.
I know.
A bad pun, but that's the way it is. Sergio, talk to us. Yeah, exactly. Weedy and wet this time of year. Sergio, talk to us about the politics involved here, because the efforts to move toward building a southern reservoir was a real focal fight between Republicans in Tallahassee that wound up with a compromise that is earmarking hundreds of millions of dollars in order to boost up the water reservoir south of the lake.
Yeah, I think the key word here is compromise. It was interesting that they did finally work a compromise deal. You know, everyone seems in agreement on the Everglades. You're not going to get people saying, no, we don't want to save the Everglades, or no, we don't want to restore the Everglades. I will mention that overnight, and as complicated as talking about the subject is, the mechanics of money in Washington are also complicated. So follow the bouncing ball here. But last night, the House approved a $789 billion, that's with a B, defense spending package. Mm-hmm. But it included four of the 12 spending bills they used to fund the government. In there was about $150 million for dealing with the blue algae blooms, okay, and Everglades restoration. So, again, there's widespread agreement, a bipartisan agreement, if you will, on helping this region.
Well, Governor Scott has lobbied hard the Trump administration, both in Washington and in front of microphones and TV cameras here in the state of Florida, to get the kind of support that has allowed him, frankly, to come forward and put his political capital behind new projects to speed up the Everglades restoration, hasn't he?
Yes, and keep in mind that he is all but certain to run for Senate in 2018, and Everglades is always at the top of that list of key issues facing Florida.
Talking about the environment, the wet season, the management of the Everglades, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN, some of the best in the business in South Florida. Kate Stein, our environmental reporter here, Sergio Bustos, a senior editor at Politico, and Jenny Stiletovich, environmental reporter for the Miami Herald. I want to bring politics and science together here, Jenny, in the form of the South Florida Water Management District, which is the state agency that is responsible for managing the flood program in South Florida and all the plumbing and the canals and the reservoirs and whatnot that that make up the Everglades and the western areas and boundaries of our area here in Southeast Florida. The agency recently had threatened to stop working with a scientific team that had been and continues to advise Congress on Everglades restoration. What's at stake? What's happening here?
Well, that's right. This National Academies of Sciences will be in West Palm Beach next week to basically collect information about Everglades restoration. And normally the Water Management District participates in that and provides information. This year, the outgoing director told his scientists that he didn't want them to participate. So the Academies is going forward without them.
Kate Stein, why did it come down from the now former South Florida Water Management manager not to participate?
Oh, that's a little bit of a tough question. I don't want to speculate too much, but I think that part of it, he was unhappy with a report from the National Academies that called basically for reevaluating some parts of the comprehensive restoration plan. Mm. The Academies published a report that requested that some of the projects in the plan be looked at again in light of some things that have happened with regard to climate change. You know, do we need to reevaluate some of the measures that were taken to develop the plan?
Sea level rise and other issues were brought into question. And reopening the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Program, this is a 17-year-long program that still has 13 years left in it. And how many projects have been completed out of the few dozen?
I think it's still zero at this point, but we're getting very close on a couple of them. Six are underway the last time that I checked in on the most, back in July and August, back this spring when we were doing the series on the Everglades.
Right. And Jenny, the Water Management District has said that this scientific team has had mission creep, that it is beginning to wander into legal and regulatory issues when it should be focused on just, frankly, hydrology and ecology.
That's right, but the Academy says that they're not, that this is information that is important to understanding and assessing restoration. And also keep in mind, I mean, the state and the feds, this project goes back so long, and they have often fought over,
right.
You know,
this
assessments.
Is a contentious relationship,
yes.
But it seems, has it gotten more contentious with the current administration in the state of Florida and the management of the South Florida Water Management District, or is this naturally going to have some friction between state regulation and federal regulation?
To me, it seems like it has gotten more contentious. The Pete Antonacci, the you know outgoing director, did a couple of things where he either pulled the district out of, you know, relationships that had gone back years, or challenged the feds on, you know, pump permits and other things where he has, and the district, not just him, but feels like, you know, state control of water is very important, and the Fed should not be meddling in that.
Let's bring it back to the forecast here. We're only, let's call it August at this point. We still got many, many moons left in the wet season. We're coming into the heat of storm season, Jenny. As I mentioned, Lake Okeechobee is well below the level where the Army Corps of Engineers throws open the gates to the east and the west. What do the hydrologists and the ecologists who you talk to say about the condition and the ability for our ecosystem to kind of absorb what still may be ahead?
Well, I think they're going to keep trying to move that water out. Like you said earlier, the lake is only at 12.7 feet. They've got a couple more feet to go. It's the, you know, midway, I guess, through the rainy season. So we'll just have to see what happens. A couple of years ago when we had an El Nino, we had a very heavy rain. But this year there's not one. So we'll see.
Kate Stein, what do we know what's next on the Southern Reservoir with the Army Corps requesting this month delay for its assessment? What's to come? What's that timeline look like?
Well, I'm not sure of the exact dates, but basically what needs to happen is the two main agencies involved in this plan need to kind of put their heads together and figure out, you know, where are we going to build this reservoir exactly? Are we expanding on current stormwater treatment mm-hmm. areas? So all that needs to be finalized, and then, you know, hopefully start construction in the next year, 2 years, 3 years.
In the meantime, Sergio, it's an early legislative cycle in 2018. Water isn't going to go anywhere anytime soon. It was a big issue this cycle. Do you anticipate it to come back in a very big way after this real big compromise on the Southern Reservoir?
Well, I think it's always going to be a topic. At least they settled this big issue in this session, and as you said earlier, they found compromise, which is always good. But I heard something earlier about there's always fighting. Yes, there's always fighting on every subject like this.
You can always expect the weather to change and always to have expect political friction regarding water in the state of Florida. Jenny Stiletovich covering the environment for our partner, the Miami Herald, from our studios in Doral. Jenny, great to have you back on the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Kate Stein, reporting on the environment and transportation for us at WLRN. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks, Tom.
Sergio isn't going to go anywhere. His headphones stay on. He sticks with us. He's senior editor at Politico Florida. We are going to talk about the federal and state governments hoping to increase pressure on Venezuela as Venezuela nears a showdown vote this weekend. Coming up, is the collapse of a country affecting you or your family? Let us know. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, as the roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. The serious threat and the surreal nature of the crisis in Venezuela is up next here on the Roundup. First, the serious. Thursday night, family members of American workers at the U.S. Embassy in Caracas were ordered to return to the United States before a scheduled national vote in Venezuela this weekend. That vote would form a new legislative body stacked with supporters from President Nicolas Maduro. It would supersede the National Assembly, which is controlled by opposition forces, and the new body would essentially have the ability to rewrite the Constitution and likely install Maduro as a de facto dictator in Venezuela. The U.S. government is continuing to step up pressure on Venezuela to cancel the vote. The Trump administration has threatened to end its purchase of Venezuelan oil if the vote is held. That would cut off a big source of hard currency for the country with its economy in shambles. And Florida Governor Rick Scott wants to block the state of Florida from investing pension money on behalf of state workers that could benefit the Venezuelan government. That's the serious. And then there's the surreal. At a rally last weekend, President Maduro played for supporters a version of this hit song, Despacito. But instead of lyrics about romance and seduction, it praises Maduro and his plans to change the Venezuelan constitution. So the politics, the people, and the pressure on Venezuela, pressure that may be felt in your family, your community, your neighborhood, 800-743-WLRN to join our conversation, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. We're going to begin with Andrew Rosati, reporter for Bloomberg, joining us on the telephone from Caracas. Andrew, what are the conditions in the capital city today?
Caracas is weirdly calm after a two-day national strike here. The opposition is calling for the, it's called the takeover of Caracas again, in protests through the weekend in the lead-up to this vote. They want to see a big turnout on the streets before Sunday. And, well, it means to be seen if we're going to get those numbers in Caracas. These protests have been going on for over 4 months now. We've seen over 100 lives have been lost as these street demonstrations have moved forward. And there's a sense of everyone's on tenterhooks, but we're not sure what's going to happen over the next, I would say, 48 hours or so.
Is the vote still on?
As of this moment, the vote is still on. Former Spanish Prime Minister Zapatero is here. He is trying to negotiate a deal, trying to see if we can delay the vote or call it off entirely. There's a lot of talk of some backroom deal in the works, but it remains to be seen. As of yesterday, the president called out to the opposition to come down and sit at the negotiating table with him. But we are widely seeing that they've promised to move forward with it despite the protest and the threat of sanctions from the U.S.
Is there logistical considerations if it were to cancel or postpone the vote? In other words, could it do it at any time, even on Sunday morning? Just the statement goes out and the polling places don't open?
I mean, oftentimes in Venezuela, we get major announcements at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
A few weeks ago, former mayor of Chacao and one of the most renowned Venezuelan politicians, Leopoldo Lopez, was sent to house arrest overnight. That information came out, you know, before sunup here. And my point is, oftentimes these things will come out of the Supreme Court or they'll come out of the president himself. So, I'm open to anything happening. I haven't ruled out personally, or the press hasn't ruled out personally, that something could happen last minute. Still, it's not looking good at this point.
Andrew, not looking good for a cancellation that the vote will be on, you mean?
Correct.
Gotcha. Andrew Rosati is with us from Caracas. He's with Bloomberg. Let me bring in Lara Wafer. She is editorial director and co-founder of Efecto Cucuyo, an independent news organization covering Venezuela. Lara is here in South Florida. What are you hearing about conditions throughout Venezuela, Lara?
Well, I will say, regarding to your previous question, that probably these 48 hours, non-Venezuelan will sleep by any means. I mean, the one that are outside the country and the one that live within Venezuela. I think the next 48 hours are crucial. We are definitely hoping that some kind of negotiation comes to an end, and the constituyente election, I'm not sure if I will call it election in the whole term, because it's something that Maduro just came up and he basically imposed the candidates, and if the constituyente takes place on Sunday, and if they win, we have no idea what is going to happen on Monday, but we know for sure that all the 500 constituyentes that are going to be elected are going to be completely obedient to Maduro's orders.
Lara, let me ask you, UN envoy told CNN that if there is a vote on Sunday, it will bring, in their estimation, the country to the brink of civil war. You mentioned if there is a vote on Sunday, you don't know what's going to happen on Monday. Do you agree that Venezuela could effectively be in a civil war if it hasn't already?
We have been in the brink of a civil war for the last, 15 years or so. Probably not as much as right now, But the fact is that we have been having these riots and these unsettled conflict for the last few months. But the reality is, whenever the police or the National Guard comes, heavily armed, the people just run, or the people will defend themselves with stones or Molotov bombs. Mm. But the main part of the population is not armed, and if they are armed, they are not willing to fight with arms against the army or the police. Mm. So that's not likely for me to happen, at least the formal civil war. I think uncertainty is what rules right now. So we basically have no idea what is going to happen on Monday.
Laura, stay on the line with us. I want to go back to Caracas, and we're going to get more phone calls from South Floridians. And Sergio, I want to hear about your thoughts on some of the actions that the governor is trying to take here in the state of Florida. But I want to go back to Caracas with Andrew Rosati from Bloomberg. Andrew, we've heard from the Trump administration that it has threatened to stop the importation of Venezuelan oil. This is really the sole source of hard currency for the regime. What does that threat mean in Caracas if it goes forward with it and stops buying Venezuelan crude?
I mean, I think it should be said right off the bat that there's a huge amount of fear of this would happen on both sides of the political divide. Both the opposition and, you know, the government themselves have really warned against this. You know, the Venezuelan population has been suffering from this economic collapse for quite some time. And if you cut off one of their main forms of cash flows here, it could have a devastating effect here. You know, economists and analysts, and again, the opposition themselves warned this could create a refugee crisis. Much unlike what you're seeing of Venezuelans immigrating to South Florida, I'm talking about an outpouring of Venezuela across the border to Colombia or Brazil. If they cut off this form of income, because the United States is the main buyer of oil that actually pays in cash, it's hard to see how the government would be able to make up that loss. And we're talking about the fears of a defaulting on their debt, getting further excluded from international markets. It could have a serious, serious effect on reaching on all sides of the economy here.
Even more destabilizing for the entire region there, no doubt about it. Sergio Bustos, this is where we want to bring in Florida into this. This is certainly a local story, a personal story for many South Floridians. We'll get to those phone calls in a second. But Governor Scott making some noise over the past couple of weeks, wanting to prohibit the state of Florida from doing business with entities that may be doing business with the government of Florida. What's he likely to propose at a cabinet meeting in August?
Yeah, he's trying to, and he's a member of this three-member board of what's called the State Board Administration. And basically the SBA oversees more than $190 billion in assets. This is basically pension funds and the like from Florida. And he wants to get the SBA to not allow anyone, the state, to do business with companies that directly or through some kind of subsidiary conduct transactions like lending money or extending credit to the Venezuelan government.
And what he has said is that there's no prohibition right now on this. There's also no investments happening right now, but they want to ensure that it doesn't happen in the future.
Correct. Yeah. And as you can tell from your other experts here, you know, this is a small, I would say, move on the part of the state of Florida. The bigger move is dealing with oil.
The oil, that's hard currency, as Andrew is reporting.
And I will say this, I was just in Washington for 2 weeks working in the political offices up there, and it's interesting how the Venezuelan issue is really big in South Florida because of, number one, the population here, you know, Doralzuela, and you've got Weston, you know, Suela.
Yep.
But beyond South Florida, I don't think it's not getting as much attention.
Senator Rubio, I think today, is holding a roundtable in the Senate regarding the issue of Venezuela, trying to probably populate and socialize some of these ideas. Here,
yeah, and I think he's calling attention to it. But again, he's holding a roundtable with Carlos Corbello and Congresswoman Elena Roslin. Again, you're speaking to the same group.
Yeah, it's not the legislators from West Virginia, Oregon, or my home state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones here. I want to go to Juan in Miami Shores. Juan, go ahead. You are on the radio. Your thoughts.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. Go ahead. Your time's quick.
Okay. Well, I just want to say that I want a message for the opposition leaders and a message for the opposition people in Venezuela is to reach out to those in opposition that used to support the government and don't support the government anymore. There is a lot of people right now that used to support the government. They don't support it anymore. And we just need a piece of these people to be united with the opposition, and they will be able to succeed. So basically what I'm saying is we need some of the leaders from the Chavistas in a transition government. Mm. But, and there are a lot of dissent.
Juan,
a lot of them.
Juan, I hear you. Let me put that to Lara Wafer with Efecto Cucuyo. What do you think about that idea, Lara? Is that possible? Is that kind of coalition opposition possible?
It I don't know if it's possible, but I know it's absolutely necessary. Mm. I mean, trying to have a transition in Venezuela, wiping out or ignoring all the people that support Chavez and Nicolas Maduro is not going to be possible. I know they, right now, they are not the majority and they are behaving like they are, but they are not anymore. But that's part of democracy, living with the people that thinks differently from us.
In Doral, Francisco has been on the line. Francisco, thank you for your call. You are on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'm concerned about how we get awareness for the current media when it's kind of 48 hours before the vote. It's kind of late, and really, for years, Venezuela has been a hotbed for training for Hezbollah. You don't know the kind of bad things that have been going on there, not just money laundering, narco-terrorism, training. My God, the complexity of the problem.
Yeah.
It's like having a multi-cancerous patient, and you've never done anything but take it home. This is so concerning, because I've been dead in Venezuela for 10 years, and I'm only able to vote this past July 15th. Mm. I haven't been able to do that for 10 years. And I'm an American citizen, but I left Venezuela, and my kids were 24, 23, and 13. I've never, or you'll never imagine what it was like to have a free country.
Mm. Francisco,
so,
understanding
Venezuela requires a lot of complexity and awareness in a very complex level. It's not a simple issue, and the time that you've given it is so little. I'm afraid it's going to happen on Sunday.
Francisco, we can hear the concern certainly in your voice, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us. I want to get one quick call in from Weston in Broward County. Jack, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes. First of all, the civil war is impossible because the people have no arms. They are totally disarmed, and Maduro is going to kill anybody because he takes orders from Fidel Castro. The United States has to step up and has to pick up Maduro and pick up Diosdado Cabello, who are drug dealers, and we'll go from there. We need help. I mean, we're not going to be able to get out of to get Maduro out.
Jack,
the way we're doing it.
Just a quick question of clarification. When you're talking about orders from a Cuban leader, I'm presuming you mean Raul Castro, since
Raul.
Okay, just noted there. Jack, we appreciate your thoughts. Thank you for sharing them with us here. Lara Wafer with Efecto Cucuyo, what are you hearing in those voices from South Florida and the concern that they're expressing for Venezuela this weekend?
Yeah, I hear a lot of desperation. I hear a lot of the people is starting to lose hope. And the people is extremely concerned because we have so many relatives and friends living there, and I think the what make it worse is not knowing what is going to happen next. We have no idea. I mean, I just will say that Maduro, Zapatero, and probably two or three people from the opposition knows what is happening really right now in Venezuela. So uncertainty make it really, really bad. But I am confident that at the end, something good will come out of it. Hopefully, it will be sooner than later.
add a bit of an exasperation there at the end, Lara. Andrew Rosati with Bloomberg in Caracas is you're bracing for the next 48 hours. If that oil money stops coming in from the federal government of the United States into Venezuela, we know of the medicine shortages and the food shortages and the toilet paper shortages How soon could it get worse without that U.S. oil money?
I think almost immediately. I think in a recent article in the Miami Herald, Senator Rubio said that they were analyzing a plan that it would not affect the average Venezuelans or to that regard. And again, if you take away the main source of income, of cash flows, you know, almost every economist I've spoken to said this will be a devastating effect across the board for Venezuelans. I have not spoken to an expert that said there's a way that you can only affect the government or only affect those and powers, right, and not affect the Venezuelan people.
Andrew, we've got to leave it there. We're short on time here. Good luck. We'll be listening and watching for your reports. Andrew Rosati with Bloomberg in Caracas. Lara Wafer is the editorial director and co-founder of Efecto Cocuyo, an independent news site following Venezuela. She's with us here in South Florida. Lara, thank you for your time. And Sergio Bustos, of course, the Florida editor for Politico Florida, thank you for the whole hour as well. That is the Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien, Teresa Furtado, our digital director, Katie Lepre, our engagement editor. We've got our news directors, Terrence Shepard, Alicia Zuckerman, editorial director, Jason Zabka, technical supervisor. Thanks for the phone calls. I'm Tom Hudson.